the church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Imagine falling from the frying pan of Nazi occupation, the brief respite of American occupation, into the fire of Russian occupation. That's just a little bit of the story that we're hearing from Dr. Uwe Simonetto. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We recorded a series of interviews with Dr. Uwe Simonetto about growing up in Nazi Germany and communist East Germany. Uwe is a native of Germany, former religion editor for United Press International, senior distinguished fellow for 1517, and author of the new book, Urchin at War, The Tale of a Leipzig Rascal and His Lutheran Granny, Under Bombs in Nazi Germany. Last time, we talked about how his grandmother protected him during the Nazi occupation and was a great theological influence on him. Let's pick up where we left off. I asked Uwe, your grandmother would say, this is not my war. What did she mean?
Well, she explained this, in fact, to this Gestapo guy. We are Christians and we're monarchists. We have nothing to do with this government. It is not Christian, and it doesn't correspond to the German traditions and German culture. Of course, she knew of the war crimes, but she didn't tell me much about that. My father did, and I'd like to get to that in a second again, because I just remember an important thing that happened. But my grandmother did her utmost to keep Nazi ideology, Nazi personalities, the Nazis, the name of Hitler, out of her home. We were an island, if you will, within one of many. I mean, many of our friends were the same way, found out later. We led our lives, we lived in different universes. The Nazis did their thing. We couldn't stop them, unfortunately. But that was that. And when I asked her about Hitler, or talked about something I learned at school, she just immediately switched the conversation to, have you done Luther's More Catechism? Have you read so-and-so in Luther's More Catechism? Have you read so-and-so in the Bible? Or repeat what I taught you about the Saxon dynasty, the royal family of Saxony. This is how she did it. Now, there is one thing I think I mentioned to you in a previous episode that my father told me about Auschwitz. When I visited my father much later in life, I was already a young journalist, which discussed all this, and he said, well, you know, there was actually something we did do during the war. We, meaning the district attorney's office or the prosecutor's office of Leipzig. You have to understand that in the Nazi era, there were two types of legal system. There was the Nazi legal system that was tried in the so-called people's courts, which my father did not belong. And then there was the traditional Roman law legal system, the same that had prevailed under the monarchy and then under the Weimar Republic. Now, there, of course, were Jewish judges, Jewish prosecutors, quite a few of them. They were removed. However, my father told me that in his office. He personally was not involved because he was simply a juvenile delinquency attorney. But there were colleagues in his office who arrested Jews to save them. The reason was once they, on a trumped up charge, I mean, totally benign, they arrested them, but then they were in the hands of the jurisprudence of the normal traditional legal system of Germany and out of the hands of the Gestapo. So they were well cared for, they were given good rooms, they could receive as many visitors as they wished. Christian friends provided them with extra food while they were being detained. And in the meantime, they arranged for exit permits or for visas to the United States, for example, or to France or elsewhere. So that was a way of protecting them until they were allowed to travel abroad and to leave Germany. So that was actually, and my father explained this to me in great detail, that in Leipzig in particular, Leipzig being a very anti-Nazi city, that seems to have been rather prevalent. There's something else I wanted to tell you, slip in quickly, Todd. When I came back from this horrible parsonage outside Leipzig with a Nazi pastor, my grandmother discovered black marks all over my body and, of course, in my face from all the beatings, and decided there and then, you're not going to go back. We're either going to live together or die together, but we're going to be together. Curiously, these very same words my father-in-law spoke, it was in September of 1940, when Jillian, his daughter, now my wife, stood at the railway station at the boat train, about to board the boat train to take her to the ship that was called the City of Benares, to take her to Canada, and from there she would have traveled by train to the United States. And my father-in-law stormed onto the platform in his captain's uniform, he was a captain in the Home Guards, slung his daughter over his shoulder and said, "You're not going. We either live together or we die together." And thank God he did, because the city of Benares on the 18th of September 1940 was sunk by a German submarine, and 77 of the 90 children aboard drowned. The second thing is like my mother, my wife and I doing the same thing the day that the war broke out. I mean, we paddled around the outside the street in our red pedal cars. So that's I just wanted to slip that in. But as for the my grandmother's position to the Nazis on protecting me, it was simply that she kept all Nazi ideology away from me. She did not allow me to go to the local parish church because it was a German Christian parish, meaning a pro-Nazi parish. And when I returned from the parsonage in the countryside, she would not even send me to any other Lutheran parish in Leipzig for catechism and all these things. She said, not while this stuff is going on. My father then saw to it that I was sent to his church, which was a Reformed church, which had been notoriously anti-Nazi. Mind you, I didn't like the church very much. It was stone cold. There was no liturgy. I mean, the services were very unattractive. But very, very noble women looked after us, noble in their behavior. I don't know if they were noble, from noble families. And I'm still very grateful to them.
How did Nazism grow more fanatical near the end of the war?
Well, it grew more fanatical because in the sense that as they were losing the war, they, for example, drafted elderly men and children and radicalized them because, I mean, they were determined to fight this war to the very end. I only know this because we had a friend little Ellie was 14 and when I was 8 or so, but he was in our school. And this must have been in 1944, he was assigned to an anti-aircraft battery and, of course, within days was dead. Knocked, I mean, his entire position was knocked out by a bomber, and that was the end of that story. That is all I personally experienced of Nazism growing more fanatical. Obviously, it did, because we learned about this afterwards. But as I said, I was protected against this by my grandmother, and for that matter, by my father and my mother. But my grandmother was the one who very rigorously insulated me from this evil doctrine.
Even as a child, did you know that the war was coming to an end?
Oh, yes. Yes, it was very clear. We knew, I mean, we did discuss it at dinner table, for example, how the war was progressing, because we listened to the radio. And we knew that, and we listened to another thing. Not only did we listen to the BBC, but also to Radio Barrow Münster, that was a Swiss radio station, which many, many Germans listened to. That had very, very accurate reports from the front. So we knew the front was getting closer and closer. You know, it was in the beginning, it was very far away. You know, it was Leipzig in those days was quite a ways away from the Polish border. What was then the Polish border? In between, we had Silesia, and you had further up, you had big chunks of Prussia that reached way into up to the Soviet border. So this was very far away, and the only thing we knew about the war in the beginning was, of course, that the husbands and brothers and uncles were drafted and sent to the front and often came home in the casket. Now, of course, it came closer and closer. My best friend in the last year of the war, in the early post-war period, was Joseph. He was from Silesia. He had to escape from Silesia, running away from the advancing Soviet forces. And I also knew that by 1944, the Red Army was well on German soils and coming closer and closer to Leipzig and, of course, also to Berlin. So we knew that. We knew that the Germans weren't winning. And, of course, we also knew what happened at the Western Front and Normandy invasion and all that. But we knew this. And even as a child, we were pretty smart as children. First of all, of course, we were in snowflakes, so we didn't whimper and whine. But we had to be on top of things because the war affected us, as I said, because, of course, of the bombing, because of our experiences with relatives who were killed in the war or were serving in the war. So we knew what was going on. So it was only a matter of months that the Third Reich would fall.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about growing up in Nazi Germany and communist East Germany. We'll discuss the American liberation of Leipzig. And then, of course, the Americans were replaced by the Russians, and that became a Russian occupation, leading to his family's flight from Germany. We'll discuss all that next.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we continue our trek through St. Mark with Tradition of the Elders, Korban, What Defiles, the Syrophoenician Woman, and Healing of the Deaf Mute. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, for The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study on demand. Listen at thewordendures.org or your favorite podcast provider.
Oh, invited to Oktoberfest featuring the Waterloo German Band Friday night, September 24th at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. Oktoberfest features a traditional German buffet dinner, silent and oral auctions, and of course, beer. Tickets are $15. Proceeds benefit St. Paul Lutheran School, the only classical Lutheran school in Greater St. Louis. Learn more and purchase tickets by calling 618-633-2202. Oktoberfest is sponsored in part by Baker Construction, Bunker Hill Chiropractic, Lutheran Church Extension Fund, and Lutheran Public Radio. Oktoberfest, Friday night, September 24th at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. 618-633-2202.
Solid. Serious. Substantive. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Do you want a church with a rockin' band and a sermon series to help you live a better life? It's not here. Bethany Evangelical Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights offers authentic, historic Christianity to a world awash in fads and entertainment, and offers forgiveness of sins to people overwhelmed with guilt and shame. Join us Sundays at 9:30 on Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights, Illinois, to receive the life-giving gifts of God with us. Find out more online at bethanylcms.org.
Truth, freedom, and vocation are the pillars of a Concordia University Chicago education. Through them, we form our students for lives of influence and service for the common good. This is the education American society needs right now. I'm Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, and I invite you to visit us to discover what it means for truth, freedom, and vocation to become the pillars of your future. Learn more at cuchicago.edu.
In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Simonetto's story about growing up in Nazi Germany and communist East Germany. I'm Todd Wilkin, your link to Issues Etc. A belated 74th birthday greetings to the U.S. Air Force established on September 18th, 1947. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces supports all Lutheran Church Missouri Synod chaplains who serve on active duty in the reserves, the National Guard, Civil Air Patrol, and Coast Guard Auxiliary. LCMS chaplains deliver Word and Sacrament ministry to our military personnel and their families. Find out more about their service at lcms.org/armed forces. Serving those who serve, LCMS ministry to the armed forces, lcms.org/armed forces. Uwe, tell us about the American liberation of the city of Leipzig.
Oh, that was interesting. Yeah, it was. Actually, it's very funny. The Americans liberated Leipzig the day before Hitler's birthday, which was, of course, a national holiday. Hitler was born on the 20th of April, and on the 19th of April, Leipzig fell. So it was a little less than a month before all of Germany capitulated. We knew that troops were encircling Leipzig. The Russians were coming from the east, but the Americans liberated Leipzig. We knew that the military commander of Leipzig was ready to surrender because the commanding general of the American division that occupied Leipzig, had studied in Leipzig, I believe, and had sent him a messenger saying, give up, you can't win this thing. But then there was another guy, first of all, the mayor of Leipzig, who was an SS major general, and another officer, a colonel, the French name, I've forgotten his name now, who insisted on fighting the war to its bitter end. So when the commander of Leipzig, the Wehrmacht commander of Leipzig surrendered, unfortunately, he asked for his gun back and went into the woods and shot himself. But he saved Leipzig. Except for a small gang of fanatical SS types, SA types, militiamen, Hitler youth, who locked themselves into the monument for the Battle of the Nations. It's called the Völkerschlachtdenkmal in German, commemorating the battle between Allied forces and Napoleon in 1813. And it was a huge, ugly structure, not very far from my house. And the Americans fired howitzers against this structure, and nothing happened. It didn't even make a dent. It's an enormous thing. So on that 19th of April, we were told by Leipzig radio to stay in our shelters. And that was the last time we heard this particular voice, because then, of course, there was no Nazi radio anymore. Then we had a different announcement. And my father, who, of course, had been at war and could tell the difference between bombs and artillery and all that sort of thing, my father heard the firing outside and said, these are no longer bombs. This is just artillery. These are howitzers. So this was the Americans a few miles from our house firing at this monument with all the Nazis inside. Then I ran out. I said, my father said, there is no longer any bombing. So my friend Joseph, the refugee from Silesia, and I ran outside, stayed in our courtyard, of course, and suddenly saw military columns passing our street, coming from the direction of where that firing was. And at first we couldn't tell, are these Germans or are these ours or are they theirs? To a child, one soldier in combat gear looks like the next. But then I saw for the first time black soldiers. Now, as Joseph said, no, we don't have blacks in the Wehrmacht, do we? And he said, no, we didn't have blacks in the Wehrmacht. And then we realized that these were Americans. The blacks waved at us and threw candies at us, and chocolate and chewing gum and all sorts of things. And they then moved into town past us and went back. And I'll get back to that in a second. But the firing against the monument continued a few more days until finally its occupants surrendered and were taken prisoner. And then the Americans allowed residents living in that area to enter, to just inspect and help themselves to some of the goods they had hoarded in the basement, in the crypt, actually, of the monument. And this was amazing. I went up there and looked and helped myself to some of the stuff. The Americans were very careful not to give everybody everything, just you got some. You had coffee, you had hams, you had bacons, you had sausages, you had French foie gras, you had French wine, masses of French wine, you had honey, butter, barrels of butter. Incredible. And this, you see, this is when we all were starving to death. This was all there for these guys, you see. Obviously, it didn't improve our image of the Nazis because, I mean, they lived a life of riotly there. And, well, I'll tell you how we celebrate the liberation of Leipzig. We went upstairs. Suddenly, a new voice came on the radio. Yes, you may now leave the air raid shelters. The war is over for you. And so You know what celebratory meal consisted of? Each half a hard-boiled egg with mustard sauce and a potato. That's all we had. And my father has always had good wine to drink with it, but that was one thing. That's what we had. There was no huge feast, but we celebrated it. Omi gave thanks for the end of this regime and the end of the war. She always insisted on saying the table prayers. We enjoyed this. We used the best china, mice and china. I remember it. And that was the end of the war. Now comes a wonderful scene in my life, in my book, which I want to relate to you a little bit. The next morning, when we were allowed to enter town, because by now Leipzig was free, there were no Nazis, there was no fighting going on, there were American patrols, and I believe to have seen also Belgian troops with the Americans for some reason. I don't know whether Belgian troops as well, because we were far away from Belgium. So we had to sort of cart because we went hamstring, as we called it. That was to go to allotment gardens and people like that and to see if we could get sell any of our stuff, of clothing or whatever, for barter it against food that they grew, tomatoes or any of these things. So we traipsed around there, and we came to a hotel called the Alte Burg, the old castle. There, out of every window, we saw two or three black faces all grinning and laughing at us and bombarding us again with goodies, which was very rare because we knew that Eisenhower had issued this non-fraternization edict that American GIs were not to fraternize with the Europeans. The blacks didn't give a damn. They fraternized with us, at least with us children. I mean, I don't know how they dealt with grown-ups. And then we motioned to them to come down, and one, an enormously tall guy, himself called Joseph as well, Louis, came down, and we tried to speak. I didn't speak English, they didn't speak German. And then I said to him, "Parlez-vous français? Do you speak French?" And he was from Louisiana, and he spoke Bayou French. And so we could communicate, because I had learned French from my nanny earlier in the war. So there was music out of the rooms, and I said, "That's Louis Armstrong, isn't it?" And you're Louis like Louis Armstrong. How would a kid in Leipzig in World War II under the Nazis know about Louis Armstrong? Well, I said to Louis, my father was a big jazz fan, and he had illegally had a complete collection of records of Louis Armstrong's Hot 5 and Hot 7. And he said, "Can you bring some of those records? Then we can play them, and I show you how to dance to Dixieland." So my father didn't live all that far. My father, in the meantime, had moved in with his own parents. My parents' marriage wasn't going very well. In fact, a year later, they were divorced. So he had moved in with his parents, who lived nearby, near this hotel. And I nicked some of his records. They were all hidden, of course, because jazz was strictly prohibited under the Nazis. It was called jungle music. It was a crime to possess jazz records. So I stole some of these things, or I borrowed them, let's say. And Louis had a gramophone and brought it out on the street, and then he danced, and then he showed us how to jive to jazz. This is taught a couple of days after Leipzig was liberated. You know, these black men jiving with German kids on the sidewalks of in downtown Leipzig. And then he said, "Can I buy these records?" And I was pretty astute then. I said, "Well, yeah, each record costs a carton of cigarettes. Because cigarettes, American cigarettes, were the only hard currency we had in Germany. German mark was worth nothing, and you couldn't buy anything except with ration cards, of course. But if you had cigarettes, you could shop to your heart's delight at the black market. One carton of cigarette was the equivalent of 1 month's food supplies for a family of three. It was fantastic. I mean, you could buy for a pack of cigarettes, you could get a kilo of ham and sausages and eggs and milk and all the things that you couldn't get in the shops. The supplies were so bad. So we had that, and to my father's great fury, I sold most of his records. But then, since he was a smoker, I consoled him by generously giving him a carton of cigarettes, so he was happy. That is how we started the occupation. In a very brief period, this was in, as I said, in April, they occupied in June. The American withdrew from Leipzig and ceded this whole area of Germany to the Soviets, to the Red Army, in return for their sectors in for West Berlin, which then had an American, a British, and a French sector. Another interesting thing is quite amusing also. As I said, my mother was a professional leader and oratorio singer, so she had to train her vocal cords, her voice, and this is ugly stuff. You know, you know. So now outside my granny's living room, where the piano stood, was a Jeep with an American radio man. And my mother, the windows were open, and my mother bellowed out, and suddenly this guy had enough and came running and said, "What is this ugly noise?" I opened the door. He said, "What is this ugly noise?" I couldn't understand him, but my mother came out, and she said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And she was so beautiful, and he was absolutely flattered by her smile. So he said, "Well, could you please close the window? I can't hear the radio here. I can't do my job as a military man because of your voice, the power of your voice." So they had a good arrangement. It was a happy period when the Americans were there. These few months, it was mild. Fraternity brother of my father's had been made mayor of Leipzig, because he hadn't been a Nazi. The Americans made him mayor, installed him there. Well, it was only for a brief period. The Russians had different things in mind. Then what we knew that the Americans were leaving and the Russians were coming, because we knew about the arrangements between the Allies and the Soviet Union about West Berlin, and we were the sacrificial lamb there. So one day, our cleaning woman came in and said, "Ivan is here." And they went to a nearby square. They had arrived and camped there, and then suddenly there were only Russian soldiers and American jeeps driving up and down sidewalks, usually drunk out of their minds with vodka. But there was an interesting little episode, and a very sad one in my life. My aunt had a villa, rather sumptuous house, in the elegant northern section of Leipzig. And Soviet major and his wife and daughter were billeted there. Now, in World War II, Stalin made his peace with what little Russian nobility and were left in the Soviet Union, and there were Christians, of course, and because he needed their military skills. So it so happened that the family billeted with my aunt, or actually my grandaunt was my grandmother's youngest sister, were Christians. And very ardent Christians. That was very fortunate because they inevitably invited me in to eat their, share their meals with them, eat their food. They gave dinner parties. They didn't have very much either, But they had their dinner parties, and we were always invited. Dinner consisted usually of a slice of white bread with lots of butter and then sugar on top. Remember, that was the Russian meal, but at least there were calories involved here. Then their mushik, that is, his batman, the major's batman, was also a Christian, of course. And whenever I entered my aunt's kitchen, he got up, was eating his noodle soup, I remember, and then you finish, you eat. So because we were very skinny and undernourished. So then they had a daughter called Natasha. She was exactly my age by then. I was 10, 9 or 10. And they all spoke beautiful German. And she had a great knowledge of German poetry at her age. And she rephrased famous German love poems by Rainer Maria Rilke to apply to me, of a woman expressing her love for me as a boy. And so we were very, very close. It was really my first love ever. It was nothing physical, obviously, we were children, but we were very close and swore that once we were grown-ups, we would marry. And then the family went to the Russian Orthodox Church, which was in our neighborhood. It was built again in memory of the Russian troops that had fallen in the Battle of the Nations in 1813. And the church was full, and I was fascinated by the Orthodox liturgy. And also they handed out, not the sacrament, but it was a blessed piece of a roll, a blessed roll. And anything that was edible was welcome to us, I tell you that. So I loved going to that church because, A, it was beautiful, although one had to stand about the whole time, and B, we were being fed. So, and then sometimes they didn't go because he had to do duty on some Sundays. Then my friend Joseph and I went anyway and enjoyed the company and befriended the Russian Christians that attended this mass. And one Sunday, we entered the church, and there was nobody there except for a few codgers, old Russians who had lived there since well before World War I. And all the soldiers, all the officers, all their families, all gone. So I sensed that there was something rather nasty. Something rather nasty had happened. So we hopped the tram, went over to my aunt's villa, and found her sitting in the kitchen, totally disheveled, pulling her hair. The kitchen was in total disarray. The whole house was in disarray. The major's office car, or staff car, I remember, was a black and white Adler front-wheel driven car, very beautiful German car, had disappeared. I said, "What happened? Where are they? Where's Natasha?" And she just, Auntie Irene, cried and cried and cried and said, "Look around the house." Everything was torn apart. There wasn't one piece of, there were clothes dying, but everything was gone, had been searched. And then finally, we went back and she got a hold of herself, and I said to her, "What happened, Auntie Irene?" She said, "Well, at 3 o'clock in the morning, the GRU, this was the Soviet military intelligence, came here, searched the house, arrested the family, and drove off." And then we found out that this had happened to all the Christians in the Soviet occupation forces. I mean, Stalin broke his pact with the Christians, and that was the end of that. And in the end, they all wound up in the Gulag. I don't know whether Natasha went in or whether she was separated from her parents. I have no idea, never heard of her again. And that was the most shocking experience, I can tell you, in my childhood. Personally, it was even worse than being bombed out, because we loved each other so much.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. We're talking about growing up in Nazi Germany and communist East Germany. We'll discuss the Russian occupation after this. Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Your funeral is the last opportunity to make your confession, your final confession from the grave, as it were. In your funeral, you confess before the world what you believe and in whom you trust, Christ and Him crucified. The September issue of the Luther Witness will help you think through this final confession of yours. It will help you think through the funeral service, funeral arrangements, hymns, and more. To purchase your copy of the Luther Witness, visit cph.org/witness. To learn more, visit witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Is your church celebrating a major anniversary soon? Ad Crucem can help with customized products to commemorate the event. We can create church banners, ornaments with an image of the church or your logo. We can even make stickers to hand out to members. We also recommend Kelly Schumacher create a painting of your church with matching greeting cards. Visit adcrucem.com and search for Church Anniversary for more details. That's adcrucem.com.
Does this sound like your church budget process at the end of the year? You get last year's budget and go through with a committee line by line, maybe what we should spend next year. Maybe you have a prayer. But where's the Word of God in this process? When do the people hear what the small catechism says about giving and why we do it? Contact us at LCMS Stewardship so that we can help you fix this process, put the Word of God first, and put your congregation on a good footing. LCMS.org/stewardship.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR21. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're hearing Dr. Uwe Simonetto's story about growing up in Nazi Germany and communist East Germany. He's author of the new book, Urchin at War, The Tale of a Leipzig Rascal and His Lutheran Granny Under the Bombs in Nazi Germany. Uwe, the Americans were, of course, replaced by the Russians, and that became an occupation. What was that like?
Well, life under the Russian occupation, actually the Russians themselves, the individual Russians, were very nice, pleasant, warm-hearted people until they got drunk. And then, of course, they weren't nice, pleasant, warm-hearted. But the Russians themselves, who had raped and murdered civilians and raped German women, I mean, an enormous amount of women were raped by occupation forces as they progressed towards Germany. But by the time they occupied Leipzig and the war was over, they were pleasant enough. The horror was with the German communists who had been installed by the Russians Christians to run the show there and who inflicted the same type of dictatorship the Nazis had. And sometimes they were, the functionaries were the very same people who had been Nazi functionaries before. I remember one guy who used to be the Nazi block warden, now was a communist block warden. He came to my granny's house, saw the telephone, ripped it out because we weren't communists, so we weren't socialists, so we were bourgeois, which was much hated. So that was one thing. The other thing is, of course, food supplies were even worse. We were kept to 700 calories a day. And then another thing that happened to me personally, and I found it very unpleasant, I was among the 200 best elementary school pupils in Leipzig that were admitted to entrance examination for the last Latin school we had in Leipzig, St. Thomas' school. It was sort of linked to the St. Thomas' choir, but the external students didn't have to be singers, but you had to sit very rigorous exams for that. And of those 260 passed, and I was among the 60. So I would have I was looking forward to traditional German education the way my parents and my grandparents had received it, with Latin and Greek and all that. I mean, starting out with Latin in fifth grade. Then one day I got a letter saying that unfortunately they didn't have enough room for us and I had to go to a socialist unity school. I couldn't. So then we had a friend who was a Christian Democrat, part Jewish, and it was one of those half-Jews, as they were called, that Christian friends had hidden in Mecklenburg, in a Mecklenburg farm, from the Nazis. And he was back because the Christian Democrats, there were elections in 1946, they were relatively free, the last free elections in Eastern Germany until 1990. And the Christian Democrats, and Social Democrats and Christian Democrats won these elections. So he was the third mayor of Leipzig. But the the mayor in charge of education was a communist. So he told us, his name was Eichelbaum, Ernst Eichelbaum, and he told us, well, the director of that school was called before the communist education mayor, and this communist guy said, how come you allowed so many bourgeois children, upper-class children, to pass exams? And so said the director, sorry, I didn't allow them to. They just happened to be good enough to pass the tests. I didn't look into their background otherwise than that. So 18 of us were removed. All of that level of society, we were not people of bourgeois background, children of college-educated, university-educated parents were removed systematically. I was then transferred back to the so-called socialist unity school, where we had 18 children to class and a communist Neulehrer, a new teacher. These were communist functionaries who in a six-month courses had been trained as teachers. And this one guy opened the class each day at 8 o'clock, saying there are still three Christian swine in your class, beat them to their senses. The three were my friend Joseph, who was Catholic, and then two Lutherans. So after school, not the entire class didn't chase us, maybe 20 or so, but we knew how to run. I then spent every day several hours on streetcars, because we ran into opposite streetcar lines, jumped the trains and then changed trains, and these kids followed us until we finally shook them off. That was a daily event. So, I mean, I came home usually at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, totally exhausted, and still had to do my homework, of course, and, well, that didn't work. And then, of course, in addition to that, I had TB. I couldn't go to school. Anyway, then I finally went back, and this after 6 months, and the teacher became even more radical. He didn't personally beat us, but every morning he, and I'm quite sure his colleagues in other classes, urged his pupils to beat us up as Christians, which is where the first exodus of significant level of Eastern German society moved west, not just the nobility and the upper bourgeoisie, but also, for example, master craftsmen, master baker, master butchers, all these people who had their stores taken away from them to be collectivized under communism. So that was a very, very grim period, and we were so hungry. You can't believe how hungry we were. Then eventually, when I had healed from TB and after a few more months under these communist teachers, my parents or my mother and my grandmother decided that I had to be sent to Western Germany in order to get any education whatsoever. And my father, I mean, the Americans had taken my father out of East Germany to train him, fatten him up first, and then train him for some senior position in the new West German government the Americans and the British were about to forge. So he was gone. Then we eventually went west. It's a very, very dramatic story, fleeing from East Germany. Now, the borders were in those days between East and West Germany, or East Germany didn't exist. The state was still just Soviet zone. You only had state governments, but not a central government. But the borders were patrolled by the Russians, who were much sloppier than later the East German military. So there were ways of getting across the border if you had guides. And the guides were usually very swift former Wehrmacht veterans, officers, who knew that area well, and you had to pay them. And as I said, the currency was normally cigarettes, American cigarettes. One had to get one way or another, or if you didn't have that, then your Mont Blanc fountain pen would have done, or silver or valuable porcelain. With that sort of thing, we bought a guide to take me over. My mother accompanied me. So we had to somehow, this Christian Democrat, half-Jewish mayor of Leipzig, it turned out, was a leading part of an organization to smuggle Christians from Eastern Germany to West Germany. He later fled himself and then became a very prominent politician in West Germany. But in the meantime, he had arranged all that, and what I'm now telling you was thanks to him again. So he arranged with that I could take a bus, because the trains didn't function well, could take a bus to the Harz Mountains. And the bus was, this transport was actually for mainly Jewish ex-concentration camp inmates or communist ex-concentration camp inmates to resorts in the Harz Mountains where they were properly fed and all that, and they had a decent bus to take them there, and somehow my mother and I got seats on one of those buses. We were dropped off very close to the border, and a guy picked us up at the bus stop. And he was the son of a farmer and took us to his farmhouse, his parents' farmhouse, and said, you stay here and you have some sandwiches, liverwurst, tea, and also sandwiches. eat to your heart's delight. We have plenty. And then try to catch as much sleep as you can. And then when I tell you, you have to be very careful, because I'm going to take you to the border, to a railway tunnel. And there we have to wait behind the railway tunnel until the Soviet border guards were exchanged. They had a change of guards there. They just bottled it off and left this post unattended. And that was the time when we could slip into this railway tunnel, which we did. And on the other side, I wish I had a picture of that. Most extraordinary Heath Robinson type of contraption of a truck waited for us, with charcoal burn on the side, because there was no diesel. We used gas made from charcoal, and it had loaded up to the top with building materials. And there was a former German army captain, one-armed, very strapping young man. My mother enjoyed his company a lot. And he ordered us to get on top of the cargo there. And then we chucked further west in through what was then the British zone of occupation to the interzonal border between the British and the American zone. And there was a funny scene. I said, I have to pee. And so he said, well, I'll tell you what, you go back there, and we cannot stop, because if we stop, chances are we'll run out of enough gas, meaning charcoal, produced gas, and then we stop, and then we have to wait here for 4 hours until we could heat this machine up again. So here I was, and he held on to me. And then my mother held on to him, and then all the refugees held on to each other while I was relieving myself into the street. And the farmers working along in the fields along the road were having a hail of a time. I wish I'd seen it now. It must have looked very, very funny. So then we were discharged. The truck pulled into a hayloft. One-armed guy said, now you go over there, that's the American sector, but be careful, stay outside, because officially you weren't allowed to cross from one western zone to the other without special permits. And the British are very tough. Americans don't care, but the British are very tough. So, in the meantime, here, then he dispersed us to farms, including one farm where my mother and I were allowed to use the bathroom, shower. They fed us well. And then we sneaked across the border. But before we reached the border, an American military car, a staff car, stopped. And it was a Packard, as I found out later. And there was a woman driver and a woman officer, high-ranking officer, evidently intelligence officer, because she invited us in. She spoke German very well. And then she picked my mother's brain about the situation in East Germany, and especially about the movement of refugees and how that worked and who had enabled us to get to the West. And she said, don't worry, we're not going to tell the Russians about the man, but this is seems so well organized. Who was it? And it was then this guy Eichelbaum, of course. And I explained it to the man who then later became a very, very important Christian Democrat politician in West Germany. So then she said, well, let me drive you. We're now near the city of Kassel. And I was to go to Ulm in southern Germany. She said, well, let me drive you through Kassel. I'm very ashamed to see it. The whole downtown area was one of the most intact medieval big cities left in Germany and it was wiped out in the airways by American bombers in April of 1945. And she said, I'm ashamed that this has happened because it was such a beautiful town. I knew it before. Then she drove us to the station. It was pandemonium, I can imagine. I mean, the station was actually no longer in existence. All you had is some platforms and thousands of people milling about and trying to get a train somewhere. And the trains that there were, they were all filled to the top, and people riding on the roofs of the trains and on the bumpers and all over. And she said, well, this is not going to get you anywhere. Let me take you somewhere else. And there was way to the left, there was a separate platform. There was a gleaming train, so-called Dus. It was an express train reserved for Allied military and civilian personnel, all their German employees, but you had to have a special permit to travel on this thing. And that was very crisp train. It had a diner, and she put us in there, handed us over to the military American soldiers who were accompanying this train. And then she said, here are a couple of packs of cigarettes. Give those to the German conductor. He will charge you twice for the ticket, but he will let you stay on the train. And then there was a sergeant sitting there in the third class compartment. And she said, Sergeant, look after these people. Well, they're friends of mine. And so this is how we got down to Ulm. Ulm is a very famous city. It's now a university town, famous for its Lutheran cathedral, which has the tallest spire of any church in the world. One of my father's former girlfriends, who was Swiss, but married to a German leather manufacturer, lived there, and I was supposed to stay with them for the rest of my schooling, which wasn't very long, but anyway, then my mother went back to East Germany. She said she foolishly thought that Leipzig, being the city of music and the big musical center of Germany, was the right place for her to be, irrespective of the fact that it was a now communist-run city. But she went back, and I stayed with them briefly, and they put me into a Rudolf Steiner school. And I don't know if you've ever heard of those. I mean, there are thousands all over the world, but they were creations of the founder of anthroposophy, which is a very warped philosophy with a sort of pseudo-Christian religion attached to it. For example, they taught that the human being consisted of two bodies, namely the physical body, which will die, and the infinite astral body, as they call it, that would, after the death of the physical body, would somehow be parked in a space called Karma Loka, which is taken from Hindi. In Karma Loka, they would have to suffer, the souls would have to suffer for all the misdeeds they had committed on Earth. And when that was over, they would be fast-forwarded to yet another body. It wasn't exactly the type of religion that my grandmother had taught me in Leipzig, in the Airy shelter, but that's what they had. But the interesting part was they have an art form, a dance form called Eurythmics, or Eurythmy, and it's quite appalling. I was glad none of my mates from Leipzig saw me do this and dressed in a white robe and hopping about, swaying about. The Eurythmy teacher was a man called Gerhard Rommel. It was Field Marshal Rommel's younger brother. I was taught by Rommel to dance. And, I mean, that is, of course, one of the amusing sidebars of it. He had not been admitted to the military, even though his father was a field marshal, because he was a stutterer. I rather liked him, I enjoyed him, but that was about the end of that.
Are you surprised in retrospect that communism persists in the world today, Uwe?
I'm not surprised because, I tell you one thing, I learned as a young child that unreason tends to prevail in the world. I mean, we notice it now more than ever. And I was brought up by reasonable people, especially my grandmother and also my father, who followed reason and faith. But, I mean, reason was there. But, you know, the people who followed the Nazis and the people who then followed the communists and the people who in the West who supported the communists and made it occur and handed over this huge chunk of the world to communists, that is a sign of the rule of unreason. It's like Islamism and all these things. It's totally unreasonable belief systems. But I, you know, in my study of theology, I focused very much on this wonderful word that Martin Luther created. It's called Schwärmer. Schwärmer are the utopians. Schwärmer comes from swarms, like swarming flies or swarming bees. They swarm about something, and what Schwärmer do is they try to draw the paradise into this world, make it imminent, and create little paradises for themselves. So these paradises are always paradises limited to a certain group of people, namely those who follow your ideology. And this is what happened in the Nazi era. This happens in communism. And of course, no sooner had these ideologies then taken over, then of course everybody who was not of their persuasion would be, of course, the victim of paradise. In Germany, I always found the tendency to utopianism is even more pronounced than elsewhere. I tell you, every lunatic idea that the Germans concocted in theology or Karl Marx and Engels and social studies was then floated across the Atlantic instantly and then was made more accessible to the general public, and then was sent back to Germany, and there it was then systematized with German thoroughness. And then you had these crazy systems. I mean, I have found that the worst communists in Europe, well, not with the exception of Armenia, but the worst communists were the German communists. They were very unpleasant, and they were totally like the Nazis. I mean, the same type of personality, the same convictions, the same firm belief that they were right and everybody else was wrong, the same assumptions that they, if the others were all wrong and they were right, then the others could be discriminated against, could be killed, could be incarcerated, or whatever else, or could be ripped of their fortunes. That is one of the nasty characteristics of Germans that have many very wonderful characteristics, but that is this horrific utopianism that comes again and again and again in one shape or another. Now, of course, it's feminism, and German feminism is even more ludicrous than American feminism, or at least it is even more unpleasant than American feminism. Okay, the Germans don't kill as many unborn babies as the Americans do. That, at least it is officially not allowed. It's against the law. But it's ongoing. Sometimes it's a little milder. Sometimes it's harsh. And in World War II, you see, we have as children, or when we grew up, not only I mean, all my mates at school and people of my generation who were had been exposed to Nazism and then to communism, we all asked ourselves the question, or each other the question, how could this happen in such a wonderful country that produced Luther and Bach and Goethe and Beethoven and wonderful philosophers? How could this happen? The reason is, in the end, is always the same. It's utopianism. It is this tendency to immanentize the eschaton. And this is, you know, Thomas Münzer, who was, of course, Luther's antagonist, was probably the worst utopian ever. The later utopians, like the Nazi ideologues and the communists, and Friedrich Engels, all deferred to Thomas Münzer. Thomas Münzer, who, in his case, thought that the paradise on earth could be created by violence, which, of course, Luther rigorously denied. And then, of course, in nowadays, you have, instead of rather of violence, you have now extreme pacifism, which ultimately will have the same effect because it can only lead to violence. One of the reasons why I wrote this book is also to warn readers to be aware, to stay awake, and also a plea to recognize the value of grandparents. Don't send them packing to the beaches somewhere. Stay, keep them in the house. Stay there. You need their wisdom, because the parents are often very unwise. My mother was not a Nazi by any means. I mean, she wasn't even allowed to attend university because she was not up to Nazi snuff. But she was not a reasonable woman. She was a very self-centered woman. My grandmother, being a grandmother, having been a mother, wasn't self-centered at all, wasn't selfish. She gave herself everything she had to me chiefly, and of course her daughter and people around her. And that is what grandparents do. And this is why I had mentioned my Lutheran granny in the subtitle to this book, which, by the way, is the first volume in a trilogy, autobiographical trilogy. I hope that the next one will be out next year.
Dr. Uwe Simonetto is a former religion editor for United Press International, a native of Germany. He's Senior Distinguished Fellow for 1517 and author of the new book, Urchin at War, The Tale of a Leipzig Rascal and His Lutheran Granny Under Bombs in Nazi Germany. You can purchase this book at issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Next time, we'll talk with Uwe about his perspective on Nazism and communism when it comes to today's democracy and how he explains the popularity of socialism today. Tuesday on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series on the theology of worship, talking with Pastor Peter Bender. We'll talk about congregational singing, and we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Jesus' birth and presentation in Luke chapter 2. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Invited to Oktoberfest featuring the Waterloo German Band Friday night, September 24th at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. Oktoberfest features a traditional German buffet dinner, silent and oral auctions, and of course, beer. Tickets are $15. Proceeds benefit St. Paul Lutheran School, the only classical Lutheran school in Greater St. Louis. Learn more and purchase tickets by calling 618-633-2202. Oktoberfest is sponsored in part by Ernst Heating and Cooling, Alton Memorial Hospital, Valo Floor Coverings, and Seavers Equipment. Oktoberfest, Friday night, September 24th,
at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, 618-633-2202.